So this in this retreat starting tonight and then continuing on tomorrow, tomorrow for a small group of you and then Saturday for a bigger group of you, I'm going to be giving a series of talks called The Sure Heart's Release. The Sure Heart's Release. And tonight I'd like to begin that talk by giving you a long-range view of practice and giving you a context to understand your moment-to-moment practice in. Where is it all leading to, and what are the major steps or the major foundations that we need in our lives as human beings to be able to walk this path towards more freedom within ourselves and to share that sense of freedom with others, that sense of a balance of love and wisdom. So I want to take a look at the foundational practices that firmly support us on this journey, that give us a lot of faith and confidence to continue, because as you all know, many of you have been in practice for a period of time already, and all along the way we need help. We need to give ourselves that sense of, like, I can do it. And we need people around us, beautiful Dharma friends, that can help us to stay on the path when it gets hard. And as I've been on the path now for almost 40 years in this particular tradition. And all along the way, there are places where I find that, wow, that is really a big hurdle to go over right now. Or that's, you know, this is muddy waters that I'm trying to get through right now. And, you know, I have never, ever lost sight of the fact that if it weren't for the Dharma, I would not be able to get through all of that. The Dharma has really, really helped me. And the long-range view of the Dharma, when Munindra, one of my first teachers, helped me to realize that we can't, it's not just about awareness of the present moment. It's really about developing a balance of love and compassion, and on the other side, wisdom. And that's what the theme of this weekend is, the balance of love and wisdom, the ability to develop both of those things that will integrate with one another, and that we can kind of call them forth as we need them. So as we practice here, we begin to understand more and more profoundly in our moment-to-moment experience the true nature of this body and this mind. And when we say true nature, I'm not talking about some kind of, you know, we hear about emptiness or blissfulness, or the true nature in a very, very practical sense, that we begin to see the how sensations in the body just come, they change and they go away, moment by moment by moment. And also what goes on in the mind and the heart. Blissful experiences, difficult experiences, aversion, attachment, joy, and sorrow. We see all of this in our practice. What we begin to see as we take it in moment by moment is the impermanent nature of it all. We begin to see how transient everything is, and that we can't hold on to anything. And that, we don't even know it, but those understandings that we learn from the moment-to-moment experience, they give us a lot of ways to be with life in alignment with how things are. Instead of fighting that, you know, things go away, we have losses and it's really hard, we learn not to fight with it. We learn how to be with it in a way that brings a lot of the heart sense of love to those moments, loving ourselves, still living, loving others even when it's difficult to love them or to see them as really friends. And we learn to bring wisdom to those places too. And then somehow a balance of all that starts to occur in our hearts and our minds. Just by being with this moment-to-moment experience. It's really interesting that, you know, you don't have to read a book to understand this. When we go to retreat, Munindra used to always say, read the book of your heart, That's what you're reading. And I remember one of my first long retreats that I went to, I was actually reading this book. It was my first month long. And Manindraji was my first teacher in that month long. And I was reading the book, The Experience of Insight, A Natural Unfolding. And each chapter had to do with each what happened each day in that. How many of you have read that book by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield? Yeah. And so I was reading that, and then Manindra and the other helper found out and said, what are you reading? You're not supposed to read. And I said, I'm reading this book about a retreat. You know, what happens in retreat. And I got scolded by Manindra. And he said, you're in the retreat. you are writing the book right now. So look, he said in his beautiful, you know, Indian lilt, he said, put the book down. You must read your own heart. So that's what we're doing when we do this practice. And I've met many people when I've gone to visit Manindra's family that they were, you know, practically, they don't read very much, and they're householders like we are, and they have gone to very deep depths in their practice just by doing this moment-to-moment practice of listening deeply to our hearts, listening deeply to the changes in the body, listening deeply to what's going on in our mind hearts. Mind heart is the same thing in this lineage, in this practice. So just whatever comes, to be able to bring a loving, kind attention, wise attention to it. So that's what we're learning here. We learn how to bring a more balanced, compassionate awareness to experience so that the mind and heart can unfold where it's been folded in upon itself. So a lot of our experiences and practice won't be easy, you know. And really what happens when it's not easy is that we kind of step up to the plate and we get more courageous. And we also get more, there's nothing else we can do but just love that moment. Because if we hate it, it's just, you know, another steel plate we're adding around our hearts. So all we can do is open to it. And so when we're able to do that, we actually get stronger when we unfold those places that have been folded in upon themselves. Because a lot of times, that's what's happening in our lives. We close down because things have been hard, and it's kind of creates that little fold. And then when we are in retreat or in a time of silence, like even tonight or the weekend on Saturday, we feel so safe and it gets so peaceful and quiet that some things start opening up. You know, those folds start opening up. And then what's been in those folds starts coming out. And it's better to know it and see it than not to see it. So I prefer to see it rather than for it to be all closed in and be there for lifetimes and lifetimes, where more and more gunk gets on top and more folds, and then it's just really too hard. So it is difficult, it is challenging, but it's a challenge that if we really want to be free, we have to accept that challenge. Or else, you know, we just go on running away from what's difficult and just running towards what's pleasant. And that's mostly what this human realm is all about, what people are doing here. That's why they say when you get into the Dharma, it's almost like you really have to, you're going upstream. It's not like you're flowing with most of the people. You're really trying to find out what's at the head of all this. Or what's at the heart of all this? And it really does feel like it's challenging. But you know what? What comes out of facing that challenge is a lot of beauty. A lot of beauty of our hearts, a lot of beauty of our minds, an ability to face old age, sickness, and death in a way that we might not have been able to face before. So we understand how to be courageously clear and bring a sobering honesty to what's unfolding, even when it's hard to bear. So as Mark Twain says, self-knowledge is not always good news. It's really hard to open to. What are we going to do? Just keep running away from it? So we can't keep doing that. That's why we're all here. Sometimes we don't know why we're all here. We just want some peace and quiet. But then we find out, oh yeah, we're getting more peaceful and quiet so that we can face what we have to face in life. So we begin to experientially understand for ourselves the practice of awareness, and that brings forth the kind of wisdom that accompanies compassion so that we can really open to everything with a soft heart, but with a clear mind. With a heart that says, this is the way it is, what do I do now? You know, what's the step that I need to take that is in alignment with truthfulness, is alignment with kindness, is in alignment with how things are, and not just how we want it to be, but if we want it to be in a certain way, we know that too. And we accept that too. Like, okay, this is part of the terrain here. And so we're completely honest with ourselves. So, you know, wisdom is a factor just like joy is a factor. In the Buddhist psychology, there are all these factors of mind. And it's not, you know, Kamala who sees that. It's a factor of wisdom that's being developed in Kamala and each one of you that begins to see it. Just like compassion is developed, just like joy is developed, just like calm is developed, these are all qualities of the mind. Wisdom also is developed by bringing simple awareness to moment experience. The guidance I gave you this morning is very simple, right? Some of you who are new to practice might have been saying to yourselves, or maybe you still do, even if you're been here for years and years, like, what is this going to do anyway, you know, just being with my breath or seeing a moment of aversion arise and a moment of joy arise. Well, there are some deeply profound things that happen just in that simplicity. What happens is this factor of wisdom, which gets developed because of mindful awareness, begins to see the direct path to true peace. It's something, nothing else sees that as clearly in these factors that are within the potential within us as wisdom. It really sees that this is the way to the end of suffering. And it follows that way without hesitation. It inclines to that without hesitation. Even though it's hard, it's just, it knows, it sees it very clearly. This is a path to the end of suffering. And it discerns, what happens is it discerns what is wholesome, what's skillful. What are the skillful means to stay, to get on that path and to stay on that path? Because there's something in us that develops that has this unshakable doubt that we know that if I follow this path, this is where it will take me. It will take this heart and mind and body. And it puts a strong intention and action towards that direction. It's not because somebody else told us so. It's because we know it for ourselves. It's not because we can read it in a book or somebody beautiful is in front of us, you know, beautiful mind, beautiful heart is in front of us and he or she or they say something that is beautiful and we can sit out there in the audience and say, yeah, that's true, that's really true, but we don't do it for ourselves, you know, we just kind of depend on others to do the work for us and think that they're going to come along and tap us on the head with a feather and then that's going to be it. But we really have to do that work for ourselves and understand for ourselves what is wholesome, what is skillful, and follow that, because that's the path that leads to true peace. So we go in that direction. The Buddha said over and over again, this is what should be cultivated. Qualities like generosity, loving kindness, balanced energy, equanimity, compassion, faith, effort, truthfulness, all beautiful qualities of the heart. So wisdom discerns what is wholesome, skillful, what leads to deeper peace, and follows that path. Wisdom also discerns what is unwholesome, what is unskillful, habit patterns that cause hurt and pain to ourselves and others, and shies away from that when it sees it. That's why it's so powerful to be able to understand one's own mind and heart, because when we see something's coming up that's not really skillful, that's not really wholesome, that's qualities of cruelty, and that we might be hurting ourselves or others, then we see it coming up, and then we don't act on it. We don't put our speech or our actions into it. And then we even are able to see that thought pattern and say, and understand, let that go. You know, don't perseverate on that. So it knows how to refrain. It knows how to relinquish. Relinquishing, the ability to relinquish and to practice renunciation is one of the most powerful paramis, the beautiful qualities of the mind and heart that the Buddha talked about. So the Buddha said, in many different ways, develop what is wholesome and skillful and let go of what is unwholesome. So in this continuity of mindfulness, we really begin to see that in our hearts. So an unwholesome quality of mind arises, like aversion or a sense of cruelty. We want to hurt somebody, and then we see that's unskillful. And then right away, just bringing awareness to it, awareness is able to see it and to see the impermanent nature of it, so it just goes away. If there weren't awareness, what happens is that this quality of selfing, it has a particular word, but let me just call it selfing, starts kind of glomming on to that unskillful mind moment and says, oh, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am, this is who I was, who I am now, who I always will be. Mm-hmm. And it gets so identified with it, and it just can't even have the space to see that, oh, it's just another moment arising and passing away. That's what awareness sees, that moment arising and passing away. So awareness begins to understand the possibility of not identifying with whatever arises. Sure, we may have feelings about it and other moments of like unskillful mind moments of it, but then it begins to see, okay, all of this is just kind of a conglomeration of habit patterns that are happening. So we start to know with a lot of clarity and courage and compassion what's going on, and don't get identified with what's going on. The ripples of the pond that cause fear, confusion, jealousy, hate, eventually, you know, the mind gets all stirred up, and eventually with awareness coming with each moment arising, awareness with it passes away, the mind begins to get calm and clear. And then we're able to see in that pond of that pond of life, we're able to see the truth of life over and over again with much more clarity and not get so stirred up about it. Granted, there are some things for each one of us that are more difficult than others, and we're learning more skill to be with those experiences. So wisdom brings about a deepening, an understanding that our practice produces refinements of happiness and peace. So as we go along in our practice, you know, some of us who have been on the path a long time may talk about difficult things that are happening in our lives with our children, our loved ones, the relationship of our hearts to the political arena, to the environmental things that are happening, all the injustices in the world. And we can feel really passionate about them and really understand them from different points of view. But there's something in us called wisdom that's developed more and more that knows that it's all part of life. It's all going to do its thing, and we're going to do the best we can to be with it skillfully and see the see the impersonal and permanent nature of it. Sometimes we can't, sometimes we can, but we do the best we can and it becomes good enough. You know, we stop judging ourselves for all the ways that we can't do it. I'm kind of known to be one of the teachers who talks about all her foibles. All the ways that, you know, it's hard. And I like to do that because it makes me closer to you, you know. I would rather be a yogi than up here being a teacher. As I speak with you tonight and during the weekend, during Saturday, I want you to know that I can feel the hardships of life very, very closely, but it doesn't mean that I'm caught in them all the time. You know, there's a level of being having some space between what's happening and the awareness of it. Some space between what's happening and seeing it with wisdom. And then sometimes not. Sometimes I feel, you know, I've got areas of my life that are, I call my hard spots, you know, and then I get caught in them. And that's a place where I'm learning. Because I just don't want to float, you know, on the surface of things and be in the plateau all the time. I appreciate the moments where there's steep learning curves, and I'm really growing then. So if you think you're going to be on this path and just learn how to sit quietly and be peaceful, that's good. I'm glad. I hope those happen many moments of times for you. But it's at times when it's really hard that when we're really growing in courage and in strength and compassion and more wisdom is happening. So when we do this practice, it's not about acquiring or gaining anything spiritual even. Meditative states of bliss or high levels of concentration, even spiritual knowledge, they all come, but they're impermanent too. You know, what we learn is a lot of insight, and that's what vipassana means. It's insight into the true nature of life. And that's what really frees us. The bliss and the calm moments we have in order to it's like the rest that we have in the evening, you know, at night. We need those moments in order to give us the energy to keep going. But that is not the goal of the practice at all. That's actually quite elementary. You know, if you're trying to reach for that, then it's not what the Buddha called the sure heart's release, or the kind of long range aspiration. So what happens is the tendencies towards harmony and connection that we have, like generosity and unconditional love, strengthen very naturally in our practice, and that becomes the strength that allows us to open to what's difficult. This is from a great Tibetan teacher, Sogyal Rinpoche. He says, "The practice of mindful awareness unveils and reveals your essential good heart, because it dissolves and removes the unkindness or the harm in you. Only when you have removed the harm in yourself do you become useful to others." So what we're doing in our practice is we're really understanding the greed, the hatred, and the delusion that exists right here in this very fathom-long body. And we become more and more truthful with ourselves, so we're able to just be with it without reacting to it, without judging ourselves. Just seeing it do its thing, arise, change, and it goes away. And you know, when that happens over and over again and there's no additional reaction to it that holds on to it or that adds on to it or that gives us another layer of sorrow or difficulty, it really just arises and passes away. And that's how the heart becomes purified, by being able to face it, see it, work with it in a way that's skillful, mainly just being aware of it. So when I first started practicing, like all of you, I was searching for some peace in my day-to-day life, some reliable and accessible calm that I could access easily. And I, luckily, I was a wonderful teacher came into my life, Manindraji. He was the first teacher of Joseph Goldstein. You know Joseph Goldstein? He wrote many books of the Dharma. And he became my teacher too when he first came to America. And in that first retreat that I talked about that I had with him in the mid-70s, he asked me what brought me to the Dhamma. And it was clear that I had aspirations for calm and more sanity in my life. And I told him that what brought me to the Dharma was a lot of suffering, you know. And so, and because of suffering, I came to find out how I could calm my mind. So later I realized that calm was important, you know, because in that calm we can really say it's a calm pool of water. A placid pool of water, you can really look into the pool and see what's really going on in there. So if it's not calm, you know, it's all kind of with debris, or you know, it's kind of windblown with restlessness, and we can't see clearly. But when it's calm, we need that calm so we can see clearly what is really going on. And he really told me at that time, don't make that your ultimate aim, because you won't be reaching far enough. You won't really find true peace there. He told me that the Buddha's ultimate aim for us is to fulfill our potential as human beings to realize the ultimate peace of life, the unconditional peace, that we don't really have to depend on conditions of this life to bring us that true peace. So in my own life, I know that, I understand that, and it's still good to have a good life, you know, it's still good to have harmony in one's life, so we have to use that also as a basis of our life. But there's something beyond that, which the Buddha called the unshakable deliverance of mind, and that's what is known as the sure heart's release. I wondered whether that could be really possible. And so I asked Manindraji, is it possible for somebody like me? And he said, yes, with no hesitation. You know, many people just like myself, a householder, at the time I had 3 children and I was a single parent, and he told me that people just like relatives that he knows of were able to reach very deep or high, or however you want to portray it, places in their spiritual process that help them to be really more and more free of the torments of the mind and heart that really keep us suffering in our lives. So he told me about Dipama. Some of you may have read about Dipama. You know, it was one of, how many of you read the book Knee Deep in Grace, and that was about Dipama? Yeah. About her life. That was actually a relative of Manindra, and he taught her how to meditate, and Manindra told me that she surpassed him in her abilities. Yeah. And he taught her what he knew, how he was like a disciple of Mahasi Sayadaw, our grandfather teacher from Burma. And she was really able to go far in her practice, where it said that, you know, gradually greed, hatred, and delusion become uprooted in our hearts, so that all that remains is skillful ways to be skillful in our lives. You know, love, compassion, unconditional love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, wisdom. You know, you just don't become like a blob. You know what to do with your life, and you know how to what's appropriate. You know how to protect yourself. So all of that is still true. But there is an absence of and a weakening, and then eventually an absence of the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And she was majorly on that path and had majorly purified her heart and mind. So I asked him how to do this. I said, well, I want that. I want that. I'm going for what's the highest goal. But along the way, you know, there's lots of things, lots of mud puddles and, you know, quicksand and typhoons and tsunamis to get through. But that was very, very clear to me from the very beginning. So, of course, the end result of this is what we call enlightenment, right? So those were the days when people did not shy away from using that word and from talking about, well, there's this person and that person, etc., etc. And when I went to visit Manindra a couple of times, and the last time when he was dying in India, I was introduced to some of those people that he taught, you know, that were Indian people in his neighborhood that were his relatives that he taught or Deepa Ma taught, who just had the purest hearts. They were very simple people. You know, you don't have to be somebody great or to, you know, have some kind of, Manindra used to say, you don't have to have a halo showing around your head. So I really believed him. So I said, well, what do I have to do this? And this was Manindra's framework that he used. It isn't anywhere in the suttas, but it was his personal framework. He said, you really have to develop the three pillars of the Dharma. And he used those words, three pillars of the Dharma, but they're actually gradual teachings that the Buddha gave during his lifetime. So I want to tell you about the framework of them. And then during this weekend, I'd like to go over them completely. And tonight I want to talk about the first pillar of the Dharma, which is the pillar of generosity. That it's important to develop generosity in our lives. The second pillar is the pillar of sila, what we call, generosity is called dana, so you may have heard that word, Dennis mentioned it earlier. And I'll expand that in a moment. And the second pillar is called sila, and that's the mindful practice of living in harmony, refraining from harmful speech and harmful behavior. And that's the basic five precepts which you probably many of you have learned and already practice and have taken them formally in your lives. When we take these precepts of non-harming seriously, we really watch our behavior and our speech so carefully and in a more and more refined way. So I'll fill that out later on Saturday, actually. And the third pillar is called bhavana. It's the development of the mind and the heart. It's bringing forth the qualities of the mind and the heart that are really, really sublime, and they're really powerful, and they really cause us to go deep in our practice. So bhavana is in two parts. The first part is the development of concentration, calm, and tranquility. And the second part is the development of wisdom. And it's because of the first part that the second part can be developed. So we do have to have some concentration, some calm, some tranquility. So these are the three pillars of the Dharma. And actually, when the Buddha went to teach anywhere, he taught the quality of dana, or generosity, first. Whenever he was invited to teach in a community, that's what was taught first. And then he taught the quality of sila, or living in harmony. That's virtuous living. And so then after that was taught, then he gave the understanding and he taught meditation. And which came in two parts, you know, the concentration and then in wisdom. But actually when the practice came to the West, because we're such a you know, society that kind of relishes and is so keen about developing the intellect and intelligence and psychological knowledge and scientific knowledge and all of that. That's what the West was interested in. So it was brought to the West first through meditation. And actually, it's kind of a shame, because the first two that the Buddha taught first were just kind of put aside. So just talking about dana, you know, when we first started, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and Sharon Salzberg, and others, when they brought the Dharma to the West, they decided that it had to be on dana. We really had to give the Dharma freely, because that's how the Dharma has been alive for almost 2,600 years. It's because of generosity, because it was given freely, and because it allowed everybody to come. You know, of course, if you can make a donation, that's good, but it allows everybody to come and hear, no matter what their financial circumstances are. So he knew that the practice of generosity was really important, and so I'm going to fill that out a little more tonight. And maybe I won't finish, so I'll finish the rest on Saturday. But without the practice of dana, these teachings would not be alive today. So we really owe a lot to the practice of generosity. And then without the practice of... After that, he taught the practice of living in harmony, because then our lives become more peaceful, and we can really sit in meditation without, you know, a lot of the mind kind of mulling over this and that, over the being blamed or blaming others and all of that. We're more quiet. So it's... and then we can do the practice of meditation well, and from that learn wisdom. So I wanted to go over these three this weekend, because it's really important for us to understand that the practice of generosity is really, if it's not part and parcel of our practice as Dharma practitioners and of our life as a whole, then we're really not laying the strong foundation for the whole of our practice. So this is the way that the Buddha taught, in a gradual way. So the first pillar as a foundation for our happiness is dana. Dana actually means giving. It's the actual act of giving. There's another word for generosity, and I'm not ever sure how to say it. It's spelled C-A-G-A. Do you know how to pronounce that, Dennis? Kaga, kaja, or something like that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's coming to understand how giving in our lives, and I'm not talking about giving of you know, our financial resources or our material resources solely. It's giving of ourselves, you know, giving of ways of helping in our community, and maybe this community in particular. Giving of our time, giving of our just being able to sit and listen to somebody, and to be able to tell their story. You know, the gold standard in the military for those who are who've gone through trauma is to be able to have somebody listen to their story, and it just helps them, you know, just be acknowledged and helps them be more aware of what's coming up as they're telling their story. So being able to be in a practice like this where we help one another in so many ways, that's a practice of giving. And it's a practice that contributes not only to other people's happiness and well-being, but it contributes to our own happiness and well-being. So I know it's hard sometimes to be able to be with somebody going through some difficulty. But how many of you have felt a sense of fulfillment when you can just be with somebody and they can be who they are? Right? Yeah? And then you feel like you're really giving something to them. You're not just giving your listening ear or your opening heart, but you're letting them know that they are worthy of your love. That, you know, they're worthy of your attention. And when somebody gives that to me, I would rather have that than win the lottery. Because I feel like I won the lottery when I have that kind of, listening to what's happening in my life. So we come to understand that it's not only contributing to other people's happiness, but when we're on the side of it, when we're there, we're happy. We see that we're really happy about that. Just think of times when you decided to give something to someone, and just in that moment, you say, "I'm going to give this to someone. I've got something beautiful that I want to give." And recently, you know, I've been reading that book about cleaning your closets out. You know that one? It's on the bestsellers, you know?
Right.
And I've been actively doing that. Like if I get something new, I've been kind of losing weight, you know? So I've been having things that I've been buying new. And so what happens is that I decided that when I get something new, I'm going to give at least two things away. And there was this one thing that I wouldn't give away because it was one of those really expensive blouses. I forget the name of the couturier, but I didn't want to give it away, you know. So then finally, I thought, I am going to give this away. And I thought of who I wanted to give it to. And when I went through all that, I really felt happy that I was giving this one particular blouse away. And so in the moment of thinking about it, I was so happy. And I knew when that person came, she actually does sewing for me. And when she came over to take some sewing for me, and that's what she's doing to kind of live her life. You know, she's mending clothes. So when she came over, I just couldn't wait, you know, to go get that thing I was going to give her. And so then at the moment of giving it to her, you know, I gave it to her, and she said, "Kamala, how could you give this thing to me?" You know, and then she really loved it in that moment. And I was just to see her be happy, you know, I in the moment I was so happy. And you can tell right now I'm so happy just thinking about it. So before, during, and after, you know, that they say that a moment of true giving is surrounded by happiness. And then she told me she wore it somewhere, you know, and somebody that she kind of had a crush on. She's, you know, older than me, and she really likes this man. And she said the man came up to her and said, "You look so beautiful." And that made me so happy just to hear that. You know, my problem is I tell so many stories that I forget what I'm talking about. So really, one of the things the Buddha said, it's completely one moment of true giving. If you look closely, it's completely surrounded by happiness. So it's not only contributing to other people's happiness. When you look closely, it's your own happiness, and that is onward leading. You know, when we're happy, it says that the proximate cause, one of the proximate causes for good concentration is joy. It's just to be happy, you know. So it's important to help you understand that dana or giving is an integral part of the Dhamma teachings. This is not just because there's a basket out there. I'm not talking about that at all. This is a major teaching in the Dharma. And so I remember in the beginning, you know, when we used to put the envelope out and it used to say Donna and be pinned to the board, and nowadays people are getting baskets. I mean, maybe that's been happening for a while, which is right, because it's something to be respected, you know, and that the pinning on the board was like, ooh, gave cringed, made me cringe sometimes. So people would, at the end, they'd say, who's Dana? Like, what is that all about? So we had to, you know, we started to develop a way to talk about Donna as a really serious Dhamma discussion, a conversation about it. So this is what we need to understand, that it's in the practice, in the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings have been given freely because the teachings of the Buddha are so precious that they cannot be quantified. They cannot be given that this is the amount, you know, that you do or you give or you offer in your through your, you know, giving of your energy, etc. It's so precious that there can't be an amount to it. And they say that the teachings, the Dhamma, is priceless. It's really priceless. So when we give, how do we give? We give so that we feel generous. I mean, duh, right? It's not about how many, you know, where the decimal is or how many numbers there are. It's about so that we feel generous. And then we're happy, you know, that we gave that. So it's something to be celebrated. And in the Dhamma, sometimes people are like, oh, I don't know if I want to give the Dhamma talk. But it's a really important understanding for us to have as Dharma practitioners. And it's also, the Dharma is given freely so that everyone has a chance to receive, so everyone has a chance to also give freely, as you wish, as you can. And why is it given freely? Because, you know, there's a lot of hard subjects that come up in the Dharma. There's a lot of Dharma talks that are hard to hear, you know, about suffering. And, you know, just about kind of complicated things sometimes. And so, who would, you know, we can't charge to say, come and hear about suffering. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. We really need to just say, you can come and listen and give freely as you wish, and we're going to give the complete teachings of the Dharma, not hold anything back. And so in ancient times, and even now, the monks and nuns would go on alms round in the villages where they live, because what the Buddha wanted was there to be an interconnection between the monks and nuns who were living in that area and really doing their practice. You know, because a rare proportion of society goes to do that. So in Asian countries, they really hold those people up and honor those beings who do that, because not everybody can. So it's almost like when you feed them, you're part of it. So that they would go on alms round. You know, it's sort of not nice when you say, oh, they've got their begging bowl. They're not begging. You know, it's an interdependence between the villagers and the ones who are practicing. The ones who are practicing offer the Dhamma, and the villagers, they offer a little rice or a little fish or a little vegetable or something like that. And then those people who are practicing can continue to practice. So that's where it comes from. And the Buddha would say, if you're not being fed, then you have to find another place. You know, one of my major teachers, Dhammana Jaw, somebody gave him a beautiful monastery in Burma, and I just learned that they couldn't stay there because there was no place to go on alms round. There were, you know, the villagers were far away. So he isn't there anymore. And I, you know, felt bad about that because it was a beautiful place for to practice. So this is how it is in the Buddha's time. So the Buddha would offer a gradual practice like that, and he would begin with generosity because, and I'm quoting the Buddha now, he would say, "It is the beginning practice for those who wish to diminish the forces of suffering." It is the beginning practice. And so if those of you who have studied the paramis, those qualities of the mind and heart that kind of like are a boat to cross the river of suffering, how many of you know about the paramis? Yeah, a lot of you, because you've got good teachers. So the first one is generosity. So it's the beginning practice for those who wish to diminish the forces of suffering. And it's one of the three foundations of, you know, our spiritual development, these three pillars that I'm talking about. So when we practice generosity, it's a very important act. You know, really when you practice, do it honorably. You know, don't just willy-nilly put something in there. It's really helping those who are spreading, it's helping your community. You know, if it's for the community or whoever is it's being offered to, the teachers who come here. I'm not just speaking for myself, but all the teachers that I associate with operate on dana. We don't charge anything at all because we can't do that. The dharma has to be given freely. So what in the case, I'm also a student just like you are, and when I go to my teachers, I offer dana as well. And so when you offer dana, it's really important to have in your heart and mind that you're not offering to that one person, but to all the sangha, to all those beings who have taught that person, who are still helping that person, and to all the beings who are enlightened, all the way up to the Buddha, wherever that Buddha may be, which is nowhere. because when you offer to the whole sangha, it's better for your own karma, because you're giving to something really, really great. So when you offer to any of the teachers, and I'm not referring to myself, it's any of the teachers, what is important to realize is it's not just going to that teacher, it's going out to others. It's coming this way and going out that way. So what you offer to a teacher who sits up here, that teacher will offer to his or her their teacher, right? And then that is also allows that person to live so that they can continue on the Dharma, to giving the Dharma. So most of the people that are invited here, I think, don't really have what I call a sugar Buddha, you know. there's nobody that's kind of saying, oh, you know, I'm a guiding teacher for IMS, but don't get paid anything or don't get. That's out of my dana that I do that, and so it helps teachers to continue to give, and so you can see it as a kind of a circular thing. It goes back out into the community and it comes back, and so it just keeps it that going in that way. So when we pay attention to the true workings of dana, it comes from a deep realization that my existence in life depends on the kindness and generosity of others. Yeah. I mean, like you wouldn't be where you're sitting today unless people like Dennis and Rich and everybody else, I'm sorry I can't remember everybody's names, didn't do what they do on the basis of dana. Then nobody gets paid for this. You know, you wouldn't be learning what you learn if people didn't take their time and come up here and give this to you and take all the time to find a new place to for the whole sangha to be and all the steps that it takes to do that. So not just my existence, but your existence too, and in the Dharma, depends on the kindness and generosity of others. So this engenders a very stable sense of interconnectedness in our lives and non-separateness. When we really feel this kind of web of we're not in this floating world, you know, we really feel we're in this web of connection that's really holding us through life. And it's really, really important that we have that feeling so that we have a feeling of connectedness and a kind of safety for us to really go deep in our practice. The people who come to the Dharma and really feel how much support they're getting, it's like, whoa. Now what we do at IMS, I taught the last 3-month course. I taught the first 6 weeks of it at the Insight Meditation Society. And now they're bringing out everybody who supports them. So there's about 30, 40 people who support 100 people to do this practice. And when they stand in front, and they're people who, you know, cut vegetables, work in the garden, answer the phones, and do very kind of executive jobs too. They're all standing around us, and the teachers, you know, there are 5 of us teachers too. It's like, I just saw people cry in the audience that, you know, all of those people supporting them. And of course, some of the people are paid, but a lot of what they do is just out of their generosity to support those people who've come. So I'm going to just tell this one story, and then I'm going to leave you in suspense and tell you the rest about generosity on Saturday. So I want to tell you about Hawaii, which is, you know, where I've been living for about almost 40 years now. And the elders in Hawaii are called kapuna, and they're greatly revered, you know, for... It doesn't matter whether they had an education or not. I was just telling Kathy on the way over here that the elders, they could have not had any education at all, but they're called in to teach the youngsters, to be with the young people, and to teach what they know of the old times, you know, and just to be with them. That's really important. And so I got a job, you know, when I'm not traveling anymore, I'm going to go to those schools and be one of the elders. So in Hawaii, what the elders teach is that we really don't realize how connected we are to nature and to each other. And so what they teach is that, you know, the word aloha. Mm-hmm. Okay, that really means in the very traditional way, I give you my breath. Mm-hmm. I give you my breath of life. So when we greet each other, it's like in the olden times we would they would go and, you know, and kind of give the cheek to cheek, and they would blow. I would blow out and go and give my breath, and then you'd go on the other side. And you give your breath, and it's like you're giving your prana. You're giving, in Hawaii you call it your mana, and you're giving the profound sense of like, may you live with the greatest qualities that you could ever live with. May those be developed in your life. So the word for breath, life force, is ha. And they would say ha like that to one another. And so when we share with each other like this in the Dhamma, it's as if we're giving each other a kind of life that we could never, you know, we don't get this kind of understanding in school, in university even. I mean, now they're teaching mindfulness all over the place and even in universities, but it's really a deep understanding, this giving the life force. When we understand, as I do, like Dennis was saying, there were a lot of trees planted on our land because the trees were all desiccated during a certain time of Hawaii, and so we wanted to reforest the land. And every time I walk out there, I realize that I would really not be breathing in oxygen unless those trees were offering it out and taking in what I'm giving back out, you know, the carbon dioxide. It's just like incredible to me that that's happening. So we start to understand that more and more deeply, this sharing of one's life. So I want to read to you, this is in the general provisions of the state of Hawaii, and I wanted to read what it says in there. It talks about ethical value, this is from page 30 of that general provisions, 5-7.5, and it's the title of it is Aloha Spirit, and it has within it this experience and quality of generosity. It says, Aloha Spirit is a coordination of mind and heart within each person. Each person must think and emote good feelings to others. In the contemplation and presence of the life force, Aloha, the following Unuhi Laula Loa may be used. And so they use these words to, like the acronym of Aloha. A for Akahai, meaning kindness to be expressed with tenderness. Lokahi, unity to be expressed with harmony. Olu'olu, meaning agreeable, expressed with pleasantness. Ha'aha'a, meaning humility, expressed with modesty. Anunui, meaning patience, to be expressed with perseverance. These are traits of character that express the warmth and sincerity of Hawaii's people. It was a working philosophy of native Hawaiians. Aloha is more than a word of greeting or farewell or salutation. It means mutual regard and affection in caring for others with no obligation in return. So aloha is the essence of relationships in which each person is important to every other person for collective existence. And that's what generosity is. You know, it's for our collective existence. When we give to one another, we feel the support, a great web of security, of life force around us. And we can give more of ourselves when we feel that. So I think it's really important that we realize that this practice of generosity that we see here all the time, and you know, all these people coming to give, like Dennis was saying, it's just over a year's time, the amount of labor that can come in, help that can come in by just one person giving at a time is immense and can help a community like this really thrive and grow. And each person can feel like really wonderful and really able to reach their highest potential in this kind of field. So I'd like to stop there, I think I have 2 minutes before my time is up. So I like to tell you that I'm really happy that you've invited me here, because then I have a chance to give. And when I can give to you and inspire you to keep on your path somehow, and not to let anything stop you, and just to be an individual within this greater life force that's giving to one another, then this place, this Sangha, can really, really be great. Greater than it already is. And each one of you can really reach your highest potential. So I may that be so for all of you at the earliest possible time, for you, which they say in Burma. Okay. Thank you. So, what now? It's 9:14. I have 1 minute to answer a question. If there's any, I mean, maybe there's nothing. It's okay. Well, be well and safe travels home and safe journey in, on your own path in your hearts. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.